These words from Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 5. While we were yet helpless at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. God shows his love for us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. I think we ought to read that again. If we were to examine prevailing American Christianity in many of its forms, we might think that that passage said, at the right time, Christ died for the godly, those that have gotten their act together and confessed him as Lord or did whatever else the formulas require. Or that at the right time, while we had finally been done with sinning, because if we don't get done with sinning, we're in big trouble and this is what, etc. But it says, at the right time, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. Well, it's been kind of a sobering week. I think first of the all-American religion of pro and college football. Kind of a sad story, not just the Tech game, but the whole notion of the violence that we endorse and embrace on a football field and call it sport. And then we wonder why it translates sometimes into real life in ways that horrify us with spouses and children, which is just another way of being sobered by how our world is characterized by violence. This is the 13th anniversary of 9/11 this week, and again, the president giving a speech on the threat of imminent and ongoing terror. In this instance, oddly and inexplicably, in the name of religion. And on a much different note, but sobering in a different way, I read a book this week entitled Excellent Sheep, which is written by a now former and I suspect disgruntled English professor at Yale University, in which he essentially indicts American higher education, especially American elite higher education. And, of course, I am a higher educator. So all this going on, and added to that, I've been under the weather most of the week, which is sort of minimal compared to those facing surgery and chemo. But I had a few extra minutes, because I couldn't do anything else, to sort of reflect on this stuff, both on what's going on in the NFL and in the Middle East and in my line of work in higher ed. And I asked myself, if I were a minister, what insight can I bring to bear, if any, on the issue of religion and violence? And is there any way to push back on that that makes any sense at all? And if I were a higher educator, is there any way to make sense of the shift and the critique that's being brought to bear on my vocation? And I thought, yeah, maybe. In microcosm, we actually try to do this. Every time we conduct a funeral, for example, and people have asked me very directly, how do you do that? And what do you try to accomplish in the 20 or 30 minutes or so that we have to memorialize the life of a loved one? And I have said, I hope that when people have had that experience, they've had a chance to laugh, that they've had a chance to think, and that they've had a chance to care. And that's what we do to get people through, you know, the moment of losing someone they love and commemorating that at that time. But it might not be half bad to include in each day and figure a way to, figure a way to have each day be a part of our discipline, laughter, thinking, and care. Laughter because look at us, you know. You might as well laugh at some of the ironies and hypocrisies and, you know, just goofy things that we do to ourselves and one another. Just having lost Joan Rivers to our life just in the last couple of weeks and Robin Williams not long ago. These are folks who sort of, in technicolor, reflect back to us all of the foibles that if we wouldn't cry, and sometimes we do, we at least get through them by laughing, you know. And laughter, oddly, especially in its form of satire, is sort of the inverse or the other side of the same coin as anger. And a lot of the energy from anger can be dissipated through laughter. So not only is laughter good medicine, and it is, as it turns out, because there's an endorphin release that actually has, you know, pain reductive qualities and a sense of well-being, but it also dissipates a lot of negative energy, at least in a way that allows us to move forward. So laughter, I think, is a vital part of every day. And there's a sign in the back of the church that I hope people notice when they come in, that if it doesn't include laughter, in my view, it's not the religion for me. And I also think that thinking is important. I mean, that's sort of the indictment of this book called Excellent Sheep. And the title is what the author refers to that are being both attracted to and being turned out by even America's most elite educational institutions, and Yale is his frame of reference, that in the last 30 years or so, the motive and method of higher education has been completely flipped, in that students are now coming to the college entrance experience and the college experience itself asking other people, what should I do? Rather than the larger, somewhat more philosophical, and I think even more educationally rigorous question, what should I do it for? What larger purpose is served here? The author makes the claim that excellent sheep are very highly skilled at following directions and almost unable to set a direction for themselves, which he finds horrific and frightening. You know, I think of the opening line to the novel David Copperfield, in which David says something like, whether or not I become the hero of my own life, these pages will tell. And the hero of your own life is a very introspective, reflective analysis of what you can do that the world needs doing. The author of Excellent Sheep says, today's most brilliant and elite college students are trying to be the heroes of somebody else's life. That is, reacting to directions from others. Go into medicine, law, finance, consulting, and at every step of the way, you just get an increasingly large collection of gold stars from other people. That's not critical thinking. There's a difference between a job, which is a set of activities you do for which you get money, and a vocation, which is something you love to do that you happen to get paid for, and that the world needs. And by that definition, volunteer work is the highest vocation. It's something you do that needs doing that you would do for free if you could, and so on. It's a big difference, he says. So excellent sheep is the opposite of what he thinks the world needs with regard to thinking. And so every day to think through the question, you know, what is worth my time? What is worth my energy in terms of both what I'm able to do, but more importantly, what the world needs doing? How does my ability or sense of call advance not just my own pocketbook, but the creation of the world I hope my children will inherit? That's a level of thought and critical reflection that I think is something of a pushback to the chaos that's causing our world to give us tension and grief. Laughter, thoughtfulness and critical thinking, and caring, which is the opposite of indifference. And the opposite of indifference is defined elsewhere by Augustine as love, actually. And between the relentless computerization of our lives, the diffusion of what happens when we push send or click a process, when you add it all up, it has the effect of turning loyalty, for example, to a company, to the place you've worked for, turning loyalty to apathy, because there's so much complexity in a social media, hyper-computerized iPhone world that you've lost touch with human connection unless you work at it, unless you work at it. What is it, again, that's worthy of my attention? Who needs my care? So these are the three things that I think we try to put forward in our micro ministry at a memorial service. But I think when you put them together in the course of any day, they might push back on the sobering chaos. In much the same way as Paul was talking to the chaotic world in the early Roman church, at the right time, which is this time, Christ died for the ungodly while we were yet sinners. And knowing that gives us perhaps the energy to find a way to laugh through things, a way to think things through, and at the end of the day, find ourselves more caring and expressive of love. So that's the setup. So I thought what I would do with sort of the last half of this is to actually try to get a laugh, get you to think about something, and then discover how that leads us inevitably, I think, to becoming more caring and loving, and then go and practice that in our life together. A laugh. Seems that God and his only begotten Son had a little extra time one day, and they decided that he would take Jesus golfing. So they go, and they find this wonderful course that they, you know, put themselves in a position where they look like everybody else. Fourth hole, 180 yards, par 3, full carry over water. God takes out a 6-iron, knocks it 2 feet from the cup. Beautiful shot. Jesus pulls out the 7-iron. And God says, you know, you can't get there with a 7-iron. You need a 6-iron. Jesus, Arnold Palmer hits a 7-iron on this hole. I can do this. Hits the 7-iron, knocks it in the drink. Told ya, I'm going to hit it again. Arnie can do it. I can do it. Does this whole thing. And God's just kind of rolling his eyes. 7-8 times, knocks the 7-iron into the drink until finally he's out of golf balls, right? God said, I told you, you got to hit the 6-iron. Arnie can do it. You haven't got any golf? I'm going to go get those golf balls. So he starts walking across the water, goes, fishes them out of the drink, coming back, you know. And by this time, the guys in the next foursome are on the tee. One of them looks out there, sees Jesus wandering back. He says to God, does that guy think he is? Jesus the Lord? And God goes, no, he thinks he's Arnold Palmer. And of course, that's our trap. You know, we think of ourselves sometimes differently than who we are. And we think of ourselves sometimes differently because we may not get a gold star if we are who we are. And yet, we are at our best when we realistically analyze our strengths and limits and pull out the 6-iron and knock it stiff instead of trying to be someone we can't or don't need to be. A little laughter. I was thinking about this, and I can't even tell you why. I have a really nice watch, and I've had it since last Christmas, and I really, really like it. And for reasons that go to a psychosis, I suspect, of mine, and an obsession that I have learned since last December that this watch picks up about 5 seconds a month, which is just nutty. And I only learned that because I also have in my dresser a clock that resets itself to the atomic clock by sending out a little signal every day, so I know exactly what time it is. And I know that this one is 5 seconds off every month. I know, I ought to work on that bug, but never mind. So what that means is that this watch picks up about a minute a year, 5 seconds a month, a minute a year. And so the interesting question as a result of this becomes, well, which watch is more accurate then? This watch that, you know, picks up a minute a year, or the watch it replaced that's sitting in a box on my dresser that doesn't work at all and just reads 12:30 all the time? Well, it kind of depends on how you look at it. In terms of approximate accuracy and more or less helpfully accurate, this one is. But I did the arithmetic on this. If this watch picks up a minute a year, how long would it take at that rate to cycle back to the point where it would again be precisely accurate? And it would take 1,440 years to do that. So every 1,440 years, this watch is exactly right. The watch in my dresser box is exactly right twice a day. Which suggests, maybe, and I was thinking about this, you know, maybe this sort of relentless pursuit of ever elusive accuracy might be better served by just stopping twice a day and saying, what is it that's worth my energy? What is it that's worth my time? And then in the next breath, what is it that's worth my love? Which, on the subject of love, I want to turn that question around now as a way of motivating a daily reflection on the concept of caring and love. You know, we've got laughter, we've got thinking. Turn that question around. Who is it in my life that has decided I am worthy of their love? Not just what in our world is worthy of mine, but who has decided that I am worthy of their love? And that's a very humbling and just awe-inspiring experience. When you discover, I mean, Telly Savalas, the old Kojak guy, used to, one of his catchphrases was, "Who loves you, baby?" Well, who does? Oh, stop and soak that in and experience the sweet relief that even if the best you can do is hit it with a six iron, somebody loves you anyway. Which then is just in microcosm the essence of what St. Paul said to the Romans, that while we were yet sinners, and that includes today, at the right time, which I think by extension might mean any time, Christ died for the ungodly, which is sadly still us in many respects, only because he decided we were worthy of that level of effort. We were worthy of that level of reconciliation. We were worthy of that level of love. At the right time, at this time, while we were yet sinners, Christ continues to show us his love through our reflection and remembrance of his death and resurrection. Any day, the sobering reality of any day, can be met with at least a micro pushback of laughter, critical thinking and reflection, and of both the experience of giving and, more profoundly, the willingness to receive love. No joke. At the right time, God chose to send his Son while we were yet sinners to die for the ungodly. No joke. Amen.